I'm Brad Cresswell. It's Afternoon Classics. We've just heard a little bit of the lighter side of Shostakovich, but of course, Dmitri Shostakovich also has I don't want to say a dark side, but he has certainly a substantial side, and that is reflected very much so in his Symphony No. 5. That is being performed this weekend with the Toledo Symphony alongside the Piano Concerto No. 3 of Beethoven. Both of those works involving my guest, who's here in the studio with me, Ignat Solzhenitsyn. And he's joined by Merwin Hsu today. Ignat is conducting as well as playing the piano for the Beethoven. Welcome to FM 91.
It's great to be back with you.
Now, pronounce your name for me, because I've heard it said a few different ways.
In Russian, it's pronounced Ignat Solzhenitsyn.
Okay.
Ignat and then we kind of move various degrees of separation from there. But of course, you just aced it.
Okay, good. Always good to know, you know, in my business. So we have a lot of things to talk about, but I want to jump right into the Shostakovich and the Symphony No. 5. As people know, your father was the famous Soviet dissident, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who really exposed the terrors of the Gulag and the labor camps to the whole world. And I know that you're involved in his legacy very much so. And so you are kind of uniquely positioned to address this controversy that surrounds Shostakovich. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, what the controversy is, the idea of Shostakovich either, you know, some people thought he was a sellout, especially in regards to the Symphony No. 5. Other people felt that he was protesting in the way that he could, and that he infused his symphony with kind of, you know, code language that people have picked up on and seen as his own form of being a dissident in Stalinist Russia. So maybe you can talk a little bit about what that entails and how you feel about it personally.
Well, these questions are still not put to rest, and maybe won't be for a while, maybe never. But we can dispense, I think, quite easily with the notion that Shostakovich was some kind of a committed communist, or any kind of communist except in name. And of course, his joining the party in his later years was not his finest moment.
Right.
But people such as the New York Times on the morning of his obituary in 1975, when they said that he was a lifelong believer in the communist system, or words to that effect, of course, words like that could only have been written by people who, or person who did not really have any understanding of what Soviet reality was like, especially during the time of Shostakovich's greatest conflicts with the regime, which are exemplified by 1936, mm-hmm. his great second opera, Lady Macbeth of Mtsensk, and then 1948, 12 years later, when sort of the whole theater of the absurd repeated itself again, and he, along with Prokofiev and Miskovsky and Khachaturian, were accused of something called formalism mm-hmm. in music, and where their music was banned for some time, or virtually banned. So, look, Shostakovich had to go along somewhat to survive. And I say this, as you noted, as the son of Alexander Solzhenitsyn, as the son of a man who refused any compromise, who risked his life in the most literal and direct way to speak the truth, who paid a great price for it, but did not ultimately lose his life for that reason. So I appreciate courage steadfastness tremendously, but we have to understand that Shostakovich was living in a different time, and as nasty as the Soviet Union was in the 60s and 70s and 80s, and really pick a decade, but it was a special kind of hell in the 1930s and 1940s.
Yeah. We should put the Symphony No. 5 perhaps in context. You mentioned 1936 and Lady Macbeth, the opera, which was a success at first, but then Stalin attended a performance, and then that review appeared in Pravda, which condemned Shostakovich. So what was the atmosphere when he came back then with this Symphony No. 5? Because this was his response, was it not?
Right. And I think in order to understand that, we have to have an inkling of just how terrifying were the circumstances surrounding Shostakovich in particular after that infamous editorial in Pravda on January 24th of 1936, Muddle instead of Music, which castigated Lady Macbeth in the most virtually unprintable terms,
right,
one might say. And so layered on top of the absolute height of the Red Terror, Stalin's terror, which was about to culminate, was culminating in those years in 36 and 37, Shostakovich was every moment, presumably, of every waking moment, fearful, not just in general, but fearful that right now they will come and arrest me, and then, like so many of his friends, will be tortured, will be shot, will be, at the very, at best case scenario, exiled to labor camps. So now fast forward to 1937, November, was when the premiere of the Fifth Symphony took place, and yes, this was a charged moment because Shostakovich, first of all, had inexplicably survived. He was still walking. He was still free.
Why do you think that is? I mean, why do you think he survived thus far at that point? Was it his celebrity or?
Stalin had a really a capricious and mercurial aspect to not just his personality, which would be sort of irrelevant in a man whose hands were so soaked in blood, but with respect to dealing with artists, writers, composers, men of the theater, he fancied himself, not unlike Lenin, not unlike Hitler, to be somewhat of a connoisseur,
right,
of
right,
art. And to be fair, he did understand something. I mean, he wasn't, you know, completely, he was an educated person, and so he certainly, you know, it's just so he had, but he has ideas about what he liked and what he didn't like, and he also, but this idea of you die and you don't die, next week we'll see, but right now I'm picking. I think that historians in general and historians of art have found it very difficult to say why, Mandelstam was arrested, but Pasternak wasn't, you know, and why another composer might have been arrested and Shostakovich wasn't, why Meyerhold was arrested but another director wasn't. Since they were all guiltless, certainly guiltless, right, of the crime, you know, of any crimes that they were committed, it seemed a question of just, let me push this button like you have on your dashboard here, and let's just see what happens.
Just his whim.
Let's see what the reaction is. So that may, and but it, the fact that Shostakovich, you know, didn't, you know, laid low and didn't dispute or argue, I suppose that couldn't have hurt. But
But then he was presenting this symphony to the public, premiered in 1937,
November 21st, if memory serves. That was one of the great, most unique nights in the history of music. I think we have some of these moments in music that really are define something much more than just that night or that piece, the premiere of The Rite of Spring. We have the premiere of Beethoven's Fifth and Sixth Symphony and the Choral Fantasy.
All in one concert.
Yeah. And what else? I mean, that program is unbelievable to look at. Well, this evening with the Fifth Symphony was one of those, because the sense of anticipation and the sense of dread and suspense on the part of everybody involved was demonstrably through the roof.
Yeah.
There was tremendous surprise that the symphony was allowed to go forward and apparently wasn't going to be stopped, and after so many rehearsals it became increasingly clear it wasn't going to be stopped, prevented from being presented in public. He had done an introduction of the symphony privately to colleagues of the Composers Union. That went reasonably well. But nobody knew what the reaction would be and what the piece would be, and really what kind of a man would Shostakovich had he become in the meantime.
Yeah.
And I think the real reason for that legendary, inexplicable, kind of indescribable success, a triumph of that night, was that Shostakovich had managed to come through this crucible and not only remain himself, but find a far deeper, more personal sense, means and manner of expression than he had yet ever achieved.
Yeah. Yeah, and you say that he remained himself, and that's evident from the very beginning, because I can imagine people sitting in the audience at this concert in 1937, and the first thing they hear is, you know, this kind of jagged rhythm. It does not sound like somebody who is, you know, being contrite. It does not sound like somebody who's saying, you know, here is my great Russian happy patriotic symphony. It's very much in question at the very beginning. And can you talk a little bit about perhaps some of the specific music and how the audience perceived it at the time?
Well, you make a great point, Brad, because one of the obvious points to make about the symphony, actually, broadly, is that the music is so personal, is so dark, is so tender, is so intimate at times, is defiant, and therefore that is far more believable, of course, being an artistic truth, than anything that was written or said about it, including what Shostakovich may have said. By the way, this famous subtitle, right? A Soviet artist's response to just criticism.
Yeah.
And it sounds like typical, show trial self-flagellation. Perfectly believable in that sense. He never said it.
Mm.
He never said it. Not only was it not in the autograph, not only is it not in the score, it's not in any printed score. He never uttered those words. He, responding to this formulation from a party journalist, he said something like, "Oh well, that sounds fine, or that's okay." Right. So that's typical of Shostakovich, as a man, to engage in conflict. Say, "Okay, yeah, sure, whatever you say, it's fine."
But the music is a different story.
You know, right. Yeah. And so this idea that he's right. And then even the famous passage from his purported memoirs, we don't have time to get into that whole discussion, yeah. but Volkov's book, Testimony.
Right.
In any case, many of the passages there ring true, particularly when he's talking about his music and not so much about kind of palace gossip about others. There's that famous passage he says, how can anyone say the end of the symphony is in apotheosis? He said, it is as if we've been beaten into submission, or you have been beaten into submission, and you walk away staggered, blindly repeating, and you've been told your business is rejoicing. Your business is rejoicing. And you stagger away, our business is rejoicing, our business is rejoicing. And you keep repeating that because that's what you've been beaten into. He said, that's the end of the Fifth Symphony. He said, only an oaf could fail to hear that.
But it seems also that Shostakovich is taking it a step further, and that's something you hear in almost all of his music, especially the symphonies, that where he takes that sense of, okay, I'm regurgitating the party line, but I'm doing it in a way that invokes satire, almost. He's in a way sort of, I don't want to say making fun, but he's displaying the ridiculousness, I guess, on the surface of that idea of having to repeat, toe the party line. And a lot of that depends, I think, on the interpretation as well. You hear different recordings, different conductors approach. They can choose to go down that road of trying to bring that out, or they may want to make it sound more like, you know, a traditional kind of Soviet march at the end, especially the end, I'm thinking the last movement.
for all the discussions about the end, the biggest issue that really informs how a conductor will approach it is tempo.
Mm-hmm.
And the tempo dichotomy arises from nothing more pernicious or more complex than a typo, a misprint.
Really?
Right. Quarter note 188 was in one of the editions. There have been five editions of the symphony. So the second and third editions had quarter note 188. But now the latest word text edition has corrected it to the original marking, which is eighth note 184, which, leaving aside that difference in four, is exactly half the tempo.
Mm-hmm.
And so whether it's that pounding, slow, stretched on a rack kind of a version,
right,
or the kind of a, you know, hip hop, you know, through the park, you know, depends very much on that tempo. And so if a conductor isn't aware, as for many years people were not, that it was a misprint, or as you say, just embrace that well, then, you know, no surprise that then it will sound, as with Ormandy, as with Bernstein, that it will sound like a, I don't know what, to me it sounds like a caricature.
A maniacal.
I love those conductors,
yeah,
but it doesn't sound anything
right
like what I think we perceive of, in Russia certainly, as of what this piece is about.
I take it you gravitate towards the former. Not
yeah,
the
yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, it has to be, and it's proven now. I mean, you know, as far as it, look, we have typos, we made Ninth Symphony.
I was going to say, I think we've found the connection to Beethoven here. With the Ninth Symphony, where the tempo marks do not match the metronome marks.
Yeah, and it's clear that in the scherzo, for example, it cannot be half note. It's alla breve. It has to be whole note.
Yeah.
And we see that in the string quartets of Beethoven as well.
Yeah,
that there are a couple of markings that it's not a question of, oh, that seems a little fast or that seems a little slow. Usually, it's a little fast with Beethoven to our ears. But where it's clearly, he says li stesso tempo. There's the same tempo. There's a meter change. It's a kind of a complex mathematical dance, and he screws up the conversion.
Yeah,
and he puts and it's clearly half of that or double that. And there are instances where there's no question it's a mistake.
Well, we should say, and I do want to move to Beethoven because we have the perfect segue here now, but the Shostakovich Symphony No. 5 is the second piece on the program, and it is one of those symphonies that has to be heard in the auditorium. It has to be experienced live with all of these instruments coming together. I mean, a recording cannot do justice to this particular symphony, so hopefully folks will come see this concert. I want to tell you it is this weekend, Friday and Saturday. So that's tomorrow night at 8 o'clock and Saturday evening at 8 o'clock. It's happening at the Toledo Museum of Art Peristyle. There's a pre-concert chat at 7 o'clock. Merwin Sue, who is also here with us, has been sitting there as I am engrossed in what Ignat has to say here. We'll be talking about the program as well between 7 and 7:30. So if you want to come early, you can talk with us about that, and then Ignat Solzhenitsyn will be conducting, but he'll be starting the concert with that Beethoven Piano Concerto No. 3. Of course, you are an accomplished pianist as well as a conductor. You've got two hats that you're wearing. Actually, I guess you're wearing two hats at the same time for the Beethoven. But let's talk about that Piano Concerto No. 3. Can you put that? So set Shostakovich aside for a second, and let's do a little riffing on Beethoven here.
It has all the qualities that we love and worship in Beethoven. The defiance. The drive. In the second movement, but not only, the deepest, most tender lyricism. A willingness to allow the world, allow every human being yet born or not yet born to witness his most personal confession.
Yeah.
And that's why there is no slow movement like a Beethoven slow movement for me. I think not only for me. It has the utter mastery of form. For a man who's still, while not, who never was the wunderkind that Mendelssohn or Mozart, Mendelssohn would be or Mozart was, but who took a longer time to develop, but who had a command of form by the age of 27, 28, that no artist before him perhaps had ever had, unless we think of Bach's fugal mastery, but that's also something a little different. But in terms of building a piece of music, in terms of the architecture, there hasn't been yet since such a master builder as Beethoven. So I think those are just some of the classic Beethoven elements that are on full view and glorious display in the Third Piano Concerto.
Yeah, well, I think the music that Beethoven wrote for the piano, not just the concerti, also are the pieces of music that reveal his innermost soul the most, because that was his instrument. Would you agree with that?
Well, I don't disagree with that, but I would just say that...
Merwin's shaking his head.
Well, I think there is something about the body of quartets, mm-hmm. and especially, of course, those last five quartets, that in which he goes to a place that remains, on the one hand, an enduring riddle, every bit the same today as it was for his first puzzled listeners and performers, but also managed to give us at least a peek in the best of times, in the best of performances, into an even more special place inside his soul, inside his communion with God, his communion with the universe. So I don't know that any music could ever be more personal and more deeper than the last five quartets.
I wasn't counting the string quartets. Merwin's a string player, so he immediately jumped on that. Do you play violin as well?
No, a little pianist? Bit of cello.
I'm curious, having sort of the artistic pedigree that you do, how did you gravitate toward music and toward the piano and conducting? Can you give us a little bit of a sense of how that happened for you?
Well, I guess it all happened in stages. I, as a very, very young child, I loved hearing music. Even though my parents weren't musicians, they had radio, they had LPs, so music playing in the house, and I would stand and hold on to this turntable and listen as long as it was on. And so that was, I guess, a first indication. Then when we moved to this country, we moved into an old kind of a farmhouse came with furniture.
In Vermont. Yeah.
And there was a baby grand piano that immediately drew my attention, and I wanted to play it. I wanted to do something and make. And so that's how it evolved, and eventually I had lessons. That also took a while to realize, because my parents were not planning to specifically educate the children in to play instruments. So little by little, and eventually, when my piano really became serious and took off very rapidly, I then went to London to study with the great Maria Curcio, and she was really the most important piano teacher I had, but also she was the one responsible for articulating what had been only a kind of inchoate thoughts in my own mind about conducting.
Mm.
And she always said, you must
pursue that,
be a conductor.
Yeah.
And so then when I came to Curtis as a pianist still, then all of a sudden it dawned on me. I said, my gosh, this is the perfect opportunity with this extraordinary orchestra and extraordinary teacher, who was Arthur Werner Mueller in those days, teaching at Juilliard and at Curtis. And so then I auditioned for the conducting department as well, and was fortunate enough to be accepted also as a conductor the following year, and so you know, that's then I guess the rest is
that's yeah. how it all started. Yeah, that's wonderful. I know we don't have a lot of time because you have things to do, places to go, and things to do, but I want to bring Merwin in just briefly here. And back to the Symphony No. 5, which mm-hmm. has a history with Toledo Symphony, although it has not been performed here for 15 years.
Yes, it's actually one of the highlights in my career with the Symphony was the performance that Stefan Sonderling led. And this was in 2002, and Stefan was charged with creating a program for what was originally going to be a subscriber appreciation concert. But then, middle of September 2002, we decided it was going to be a radically different concert than what was expected. It did take place on September 11th, mm-hmm. the year after. And Stefan paired selections from the Bach Art of Fugue with the Shostakovich Fifth Symphony, and as a way of speaking to the vulnerability that people were feeling at that time, and the combination of suffering and pain and tenderness and hope all at the same time, it was really a programmatic masterstroke. Yeah. It was something that I don't think any other orchestra used to respond to those events, and it proved to be an excellent choice, not just in and of itself, but it felt larger even than that specific setting, and it was something that I'll certainly never forget. And just having the chance to revisit that piece, it's a piece that it's probably one of the I think it's maybe the symphony that hits you on a visceral level as strongly as any other symphony.
Yeah, yeah, and we all have the opportunity to experience it live. You can go twice if you like. It's Friday evening and Saturday evening, mm-hmm. 8 o'clock at the Toledo Museum of Art Peristyle, one of the classics concerts of the Toledo Symphony Orchestra. We've been speaking with the guest conductor for the concert, Ignaz Solzhenitsyn, who has been here with Merwin Sue, the artistic administrator and principal second violin. Merwin and I will be presenting a pre-concert conversation. You're invited to come and chat with us as well. It's not a one-sided conversation. We'll bring you in on it. That happens at 7 o'clock before the concert in the Peristyle. Hope to see you there. And Maestro Solzhenitsyn, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. It's been a very stimulating conversation. I know we could talk about this all day long, but I think we can let the music speak for itself.
That is always best. Thank you, Brad.